Paperman meets such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, pull the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on media issues, talking about newsroom ethics and some of the challenges that journalists face, with some veteran journalists in the room. In this room, that is, the studio of WAMC, I'm Rex Smith, former editor of the Times Union, now writing the Upstate American, here with Judy Patrick, Ira Fussfeld, and David Lombardo. About those people, I'll tell you. Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, what do you want to talk about today?
AI has gotten a lot of attention this week. You know, after the president dropped a load of sewage all over protesters in an AI video. But I'd like to talk about AI and local journalism and how it's having a profound impact and what we can do about it.
All right. That's a good thing. We will get there, AI. Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York, and affiliated publications. And what's on your mind today?
Well, Rex and others, good to see you all. We've been talking on this program for years about how newspapers are closing at an alarming rate, and now we finally have some hard numbers to back it up. So go into a study by Medill School about what the numbers say.
More bad news about journalism. Okay, good. That's a good topic, though. And today, not Barbara Lombardo, one of our regulars, but David Lombardo. That is the next generation. How about that? David Lombardo of the Capitol Press Room, which is Daily Public Radio show covering state government. David is here, formerly a Times Union reporter, I might add.
I'm with two of my former bosses today.
Former reporter for the Daily Gazette of Schenectady.
Absolutely. How about that? Smart people we are to have hired David Lombardo.
We weren't hiring.
you couldn't afford him. He's,
too far away.
Yeah. So what's on your mind today, David?
Well, from the nepotism chair, I'm hoping to talk about some good news or potential good news in the field of journalism, and that's a state tax credit that recently launched some draft regulations this week. It has to do with the newspaper and broadcast media jobs tax credit. It has to do with hiring new people as well as retaining people in the newsroom. So excited to talk about that.
State funding, in effect, because tax credit is, in effect, a state allocation of resources for journalism. What could possibly go wrong? Speaking about the state, I just want to make note of something. There was a really terrific story in New York Focus published this week, the nonprofit newsroom, actually that both Judy and I have a bit of affiliation with, showing that New York is among the slowest states to fulfill requests under the Freedom of Information Law, which gives the public access to records from state and local government agencies. And finally this year, there was a bill that followed what Governor Hochul has said she wanted to tighten the deadline that agencies have to meet in responding to FOIL requests, because this can take months, years even, before agencies respond, can in fact drag on so that stuff is never provided that people under law are supposed to get. And amazingly enough, this month, Governor Hochul vetoed the bill that would have done exactly what she said she wanted, to tighten the deadlines that agencies have to meet. And New York Focus pointed out a number of the egregious instances where a reporter, for example, filed for information from the New York Department of Financial Services. That request was filed 635 days ago. It has not been fulfilled. New York Power Authority, 185 days. The City Administration for Children's Services in New York City, 230 days. This just goes on and on. The New York City Office of the Mayor looking for some emails. Reporter Sam Mellons, a senior reporter for New York Focus, wanted to see some of the emails that are linked to perhaps negotiations over a housing development that was controversial. 1,092 days still not provided. New York City Police Department, 1,266 days they have failed to respond to this request. So this means that the FOIL deadline in New York state law is mostly for show. It is just there so that agencies can say, oh, well, we will get back to you, and they don't. I think we've all had experience with this. Probably, David, you're one who has seen a lot of this lately, where agencies simply put you off until they assume you get tired and go on to something else.
Yeah, I think you make a good point about the law being for show because it lacks a lot of teeth. And while there are certain mechanisms that we as reporters can utilize, such as basically saying you've been going so along with this that it's basically a denial, so I'm ready to start the appeals process. But you are underhanded. You are in a weaker position as the reporter trying to get access to this. And this legislation would have potentially put you in a better position. But, you know, you say amazingly vetoed. I think everyone here at the Capitol expected this veto. No one thought the governor was going to sign off on anything that would make her administration have to hand over records in a more timely fashion. And my favorite part of this is the fact that while the legislature has no problem telling the executive agencies what they're going to have to do when it comes to complying with records requests, they don't ever turn that sort of microscope inwards. They make sure that the law carves them out, basically, from any sort of meaningful disclosures.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, my favorite part about this was that when Kathy Hochul assumed the governorship, she promised that she was going to make state government very transparent, and it has been opaque since she took office. I think it's less transparent than it was under Governor Cuomo's operation.
I don't know about that.
Well,
but they literally had a person whose job was to review the foils in the chamber and basically say, no, we're definitely not going to do that one. Sorry.
You know, and this is very disillusioning to reporters. I mean, I can't tell you the number of young reporters who have filed a foil and think that they're going to get a response in 10 days. Yeah. And, you know, a year later, they've given up the story. They've forgotten the story. And also, let's make the point that filing appeals is costly, time consuming, and a lot of the, especially the small local newspapers, do not have the resources to do this. So this effectively is a denial of a Freedom of Information request.
So what could we do to turn it around?
Well, short of getting this bill enacted, I don't know what you can do because, I mean, you can actually hope that the press associations will provide counsel that will get through some of these legal hurdles because small news organizations can't afford the legal representation. But even the problem is that even if you win some of these cases and unlock records, which when I was the editor of the Times Union, we did. We had cases that we won. But the difficulty is it'll still happen the next time. Agencies will sit on this, even though the law provides the legal fees to reimbursement. Right?
Theoretically, yeah.
Theoretically.
I mean, but there's also a resources issue here when it comes to these agencies, and it's a willful understaffing by the administration. So we talk about them holding up records requests. Some of these offices are just completely understaffed. And we as journalists sometimes think we're the only ones that exist. We're the only ones submitting records requests. But for something like the Department of Environmental Conservation or the Department of Health, they're getting lots of requests from the public. So they have a big backlog that they're dealing with. But the administration isn't actually sending enough lawyers over, for example, to take care of these things. So maybe the legislature could say, here's how much money you're going to spend on lawyers in your counsel's office to ensure they're handling these records requests.
Well, do we do a good enough job informing the public about this? And do we hold the feet to the fire of the candidates? And as candidates come through for assembly and Senate, do we question each one and say, what do you think about the Freedom of Information law? And make sure that they're on the record if, in fact, they are not for them.
Very good point, Ira. And in some states, you know, there is an enforcement mechanism. In some states, the open readings law is enforced by the state attorney general. It might be that editorial boards, to the extent that they have any clout, ought to be making the case that the attorney general candidates ought to be in support of that kind of enforcement. If the attorney general said, I want to take over enforcement of the open records laws, that would be useful, wouldn't it? But I don't think the AG is going to do that because then she likewise would be subjected to pesky people looking for information.
Hey, and also there's a New York State Committee on Open Government. Maybe they could get more involved in aggressively advocating for open government.
Has that agency been as effective as it used to be? I used to be in my frame of references about 20 years ago when Bob Freeman ran it. Is it still the same today?
They're still a useful resource. They definitely get a lot less press. And I think that has a reflection to do with who's the executive director today. But if you go to them looking for advisory opinions, they will be helpful. They are still a useful resource, even if I think their board is maybe one or two members short.
resource in terms of providing information, but again, no enforcement.
They exactly, no enforcement power.
Can't push anything out of that. While we have actually an expert on covering state government
when's
in the
room.
When's
the expert getting here?
There you go.
Should I leave?
You demand, David Lombardo.
Okay.
So tell us about this, because what you said you wanted to talk about was the state tax credit that was adopted in this year's budget to help failing newsrooms, right?
Or struggling newsrooms, or
yes,
newsrooms that are looking to turn a curve. And this was part of the budget that was adopted in 2024. They put $30 million aside. They had to make some tweaks in the budget that was passed this year to ensure that it was maybe more widely available than it actually would have been based on the language in last year's budget. And there's two components to this. The first is new hires, a tax credit of, I believe, up to $5,000 if you're adding people to your office and doesn't have to be in the newsroom. Maybe people view that negatively. I'm of the opinion rising tide, something about boats. And then there's also a tax credit for your existing employees, and that's worth up to, I think, $50,000 of a person's salary. It covers, I believe, half of that amount. And so this is a meaningful tax credit for small newspapers, and I think this is something that could reinvigorate newspapers like the Daily Gazette, where I worked previously, independently owned. My concern is that the availability of this tax credit is that it was written in a way that if I'm a major hedge fund, if I own a bunch of newspapers that I'm looking to bleed dry, I think they can qualify for this. And I don't necessarily think that means they're going to make new investments into the newsroom. I think they're just going to see this as a way to get a little more blood from a stone.
But at least you're getting more reporters onto the beat that way.
At least they're not losing their jobs.
Well, not necessarily. In fact, I understand. I worked at a newspaper. I was in upper management, and I understand the need to support the whole new enterprise. That, you know, the advertising, circulation, production parts of the business are integral to the success of a newspaper or any kind of media operation. But this bill was promoted as a bill that would increase the number of local journalists out in the street. And in quote after quote, at news conference after news conference, that's what they emphasize, that we're going to put more reporters out in the street. This will help newspapers maintain and grow their newsroom staffs with local reporters, that there is no local news without journalists. Again and again, we heard this. And now the regulations come out and the newspapers can get a tax credit for anyone within the industry. So I would once again make a call on local newspapers or anybody who gets this tax credit to be accountable, to be publicly accountable, and tell us what you did with this tax credit or what you did to obtain this tax credit, where you put the person, and what they're doing to increase local journalism.
Ira, as a former publisher of one of those newspapers that got taken over by a hedge fund, as a matter of fact, and has been, I would think it's probably safe to say, the newsroom has been depleted significantly since you ran it. Would you say that Judy's point is right, that you need to be careful about seeing these tax credits applied to non-newsroom positions?
Yeah, I think so. I think where Judy was, sounds like she was hopeful at the first word of this, I would have been a lot more skeptical. And I'd even suggest nothing nefarious if between the beginning of this process and where we are now, the industry certainly has not picked up. And so whatever good thoughts there might have been about using this tax credit to hire more people, the finances of the industry are such that even with that tax credit, it may not be worth their while to hire more people. So, and at the end of the day, certainly the hedge funds, but also now smaller newspapers, privately owned newspapers, as reflected in this Medill survey, which we'll get to, that they're now retrenching and selling and closing up. So there are not a lot of hopeful signs. And I just don't know whether this, although as well-meaning as it is, that this tax credit is going to be tremendous help.
Do we have a worry about the ethical implications of this? Many years ago, before there was any sort of an industry-specific tax credit like this, there were tax credits available from the state for job retraining when there was a disruption in the economy. And I recall having conversations in the Times Union Executive Committee about whether we would accept them at all, whether a newspaper should accept a tax credit, given the fact that we are covering state government.
Yeah, I've said it on this program many times. I didn't think that we as an industry should be accepting government money. And you can see one of the pitfalls of that is right here in public broadcasting, where they did routinely get a chunk of public money and the money went away this year. Now they're scrambling to try to replace it. But I became less of an opponent of getting public money as the industry started getting weaker.
So I just want to say that there are plenty of government subsidies for media already, and they don't necessarily exist and are named the way this tax credit is. So I think about something like the film tax credit, which benefits a company like Comcast, which is basically the parent company of NBC News. There are local tax breaks. There is direct money in the state budget that actually goes to public media as well. So there are a variety of ways in which journalism already benefits from government support.
Legal advertising from local governments that is required to be published.
Yeah, but you're providing a service there.
A service that some people say isn't necessarily needed anymore and is only preserved because of really good lobbyists
for the journalism
industry.
Yeah,
let's hear it for that. Because the fact of the matter is, most industries get some kind of subsidy of one kind or another from the government. And the government uses its tax policy to subsidize activities that it embraces. And I think that it is to the interest of government, to the interest of the citizens of our community, that journalism flourish. So tax breaks are a valid way for government to support local journalism, I would say.
We'll also take personal donations from listeners.
Well, that is obviously the right direction, not personal donations to. What's your email again, David?
Capitalpressroom.org/donate. Thanks to the WAMC listeners.
Absolutely. But I do think that's fundamental to what we're talking about here. Now, we were talking about this terrific piece of journalism by New York Focus earlier about public records uncovering the delays, the failure there. That's a nonprofit newsroom. We're speaking on a radio station that is a nonprofit.
Which don't qualify for this tax credit.
Correct.
Because of the structure, we can't get it.
Because there is no business tax.
Taxes,
yeah. So that is actually a flaw that needs to be addressed in another kind of piece of legislation, maybe next session, we hope for.
From your lips to God's ears.
Or Kathy Hochul's ears. Kathy Hochul's ears, it would seem. But I think that the key really is to talk about readership. And in that regard, it really does go to exactly what Ira was talking about earlier, the study from Medill, the journalism school at Northwestern University, that underscores yet again the decline of the newspaper industry and the failure of the for-profit newspaper industry especially to keep up.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just yet again. It's just been an ongoing string of closings. And I can recall, as I said earlier, on this program, we talked about the death of newspapers. And I know Rex and I were very strongly in saying newspapers are not dying. Eventually they are going to go away, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. Well, it's gotten later early, as Yogi used to say. And in the Medill School, which is the Northwestern University School of Journalism, their headline is "An alarming number of independent publishers and small chains closed papers last year. The United States has lost nearly 3,500 newspapers and more than 270,000 newspaper jobs since 2005. And in the more current numbers, the 2025 state and local news report tracked 136 newspaper closures over the last year, which is up from 135 last year. What is alarming beyond those numbers is that now that it's bitten into the smaller, private-owned or smaller newspapers, whereas, in other words, the newspapers are not just closing because of the big monies and the hedge funds. The smaller newspapers are being impacted as well. And it's creating what is commonly known as news deserts, which is swaths of territory where there is no local news coverage. And we can all presume to know exactly how that can be fixed. But it is a damaging circumstance for our democracy if people in the communities in which they live don't know what's going on, because it's not being reported and there's no place for it to be reported.
A lot of these newspapers that are dying were strong local newsrooms. I note one of them that was cited in the Medill study, the Chesterton Tribune in northern Indiana, 141-year-old newspaper. I used to be the editor of a little tiny newspaper, 3,800 daily circulation in northwestern Indiana, right near the Chesterton Tribune. The paper that I was the editor of stopped as a daily, became a weekly. It still exists, but Chesterton Tribune was a strong local newspaper with vital community life going on. I remember visiting that newsroom often when I, for a few years, I was the press secretary for the congressman from that district. And it was a place where everybody in the community would be reading the newspaper, which was, of course, the case everywhere. And when this goes away, there is just an awful lot. What we know from studies, what happens? Tax rates go up when newsrooms close, government corruption continues, and communities begin to falter. It is really part of the fabric of the community life that is lost when these newsrooms close.
And it's also important loss of resource for young journalists. I think my time at the Daily Gazette was really informative about how I think about journalism and then how I approach the issues moving forward for the next, 10 plus years now. That seems like a long period of time. That's why I paused for emphasis.
Very good. Yeah, we just let that sit there, 10 plus years.
You know, there's no doubt that there are a significant number of local newspapers that have shut down, that have closed, retired. But let's not overlook the fact that we're also seeing the rise of some replacements in some areas. You're seeing Citizens rise up, and it's not exactly the same as a local newspaper, but they are trying to, you know, patch together some coverage of their local government. It's not the same as a local newspaper, and it doesn't give you the same kind of community cohesion that a local newspaper once did, but it's not all negative news. And one of the other things about this report, it does discourage young people from going into local newspapers, and it makes it difficult for us to hire because people view us as a dying industry when we are not a dying industry. The print publications may be going away, but efforts are underway to restore local news coverage in new and different ways.
Are you worried that artificial intelligence is going to take the place of reporters?
I am worried about this, and I'm also worried about these AI slop sites. In fact, you
slop
see more
sites.
AI slop is what it is. And what you're seeing is when these local newspapers close, sometimes they abandon their websites or they leave the URLs out there, and they are being filled with AI groups that fill it with clickbait, throw a few local stories on, and they're out there and they're clickbait, but people do not know. They have a legitimate sounding news name, and it further undermines Americans' trust in local news or in any kind of news. Pew did a study within the last year about how Americans feel about AI and whether or not they trust AI-generated news. And of course, they don't. They don't at all. And so going forward, our salvation has to be the fact that we will increase AI literacy, explain to people how we use AI, if we use it at all, and be very careful about what we do with AI, how we monitor what we do, and just use a little bit of judgment.
Are these slop sites making any money?
Hard to say, but some of them clearly are being controlled by entities outside the United States. One study, actually a report by the Washington Examiner, a legitimate, let's say a reported site in D.C., found the Farmingdale Observer on Long Island, which for a half century covered high school sports and local arts festivals on Long Island. It was a community site. It was taken over, apparently, because the Washington Examiner found that they had a propensity for hyping Chinese military and technology. So there is something really strange going on when a local site suddenly starts mouthing propaganda from a foreign government. Once that was exposed by the Washington Examiner, the Farmingdale Observer abruptly stopped publishing. So something's going on there. We don't know entirely what it is, but this is one of the concerns about the spread of AI, that it is able to simply move in and take over what were existing legitimate sites.
I could be wrong, and it doesn't preclude what you just said, but I believe the Farmingdale area had a very big Grumman influence. It was a military area, and so that would be ripe for targeted stories such as the one you just talked about.
Yes, it's Central Long Island, and it's a place that is well covered by Newsday, a major daily newspaper, but the local community news was there. But you're right, it was a place where there might be still legitimate, long-term, lingering interest from foreign power.
Yeah, it was also, Long Island was, with so many little communities, was one of the first areas where there was a lot of consolidation among the press ownership.
Yes.
I think this underscores the losing battle that society has right now with media literacy. And if you can't tell right now what's a reliable source, what's a fake social media post, how are people supposed to navigate the launch of these slop sites, as Judy has called them? I don't think they're equipped to handle it. I think that there are efforts in the legislature to add to the curriculum in New York schools to promote media literacy. I'm kind of skeptical about the success of something like that, but it's one of those things that I find really, really discouraging.
It's really hard. The efforts for media literacy have been going on for 20 years now, and yet the schools have not embraced it as expansively as one might have hoped, and it's getting so much harder to tell, as you say, what's a legitimate site from what's not. And the best advice we can give to young people is to train them to want to absorb news, to try to help young people understand why they want to find good journalism, want to know what's going on around and not just simply be entertained.
Right. If you're a careful observer, you can tell lots of the AI-generated content from real content, but it is getting harder and harder. I went to some of these slap sites, and they have all the regular furniture, as we call it, the, you know, about us, the ethics policies. It looks like it's a real newspaper, and it's only if you really take a hard look at it that you realize that it's just full of clickbait. The problem sometimes is that mainstream newspapers are full of clickbait as well nowadays.
Yeah, unless there's an about section with a picture of an old white guy as the publisher with their message, you know you shouldn't trust that. That's got to keep a lookout for those.
That's why he's here.
With all due deference to the old white guys in the room, you feeling okay?
I'm just used to it. He's right. I am an old white guy.
But few readers really take the time to do the study to find out what you really need is some sort of accreditation system, not that would be mandatory, but some trademarking. And there is some of that. NewsGuard is one of those that actually assesses so that you can have sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval where there's real journalism. Of course, that is taken over by politics, which is another topic altogether for another day, because we're out of time.
I thought we were doing an hour today.
Ira keeps bringing this up. No, Ira. Oh. What a great program. Thank you, Ira Fussfeld from Kingston, Judy Patrick, David Lombardo. Thank you for joining us here, and tell your mom she can stay on vacation.
Yep, that's the plan.
And I'm Rex Smith, with thanks to our producer, Dave Gustina, and gratitude to you folks for joining us this week. We hope to come back again next week for The Media Project.
Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, David Lombardo, host of the Capitol Press Room on WCNY, and Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.